CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
While most video surveillance solutions capture and store hours of nothing, CUDA-Eye by Barracuda Networks only captures video when something happens. Once captured on camera, the video evidence is immediately encrypted and sent to the cloud for safe storage and easy retrieval from any web browser or mobile device. With CUDA-Eye, there's no network configuration or software to install. Just plug one or more cameras into your network to better protect your business. Don't get caught with nothing. Do something about it. Check out CUDAEye.com. That's CUDAEye.com.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such an achievement, who would have blamed Vonage if they said, "Enjoy better, people. We'll be by the pool." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not unleashing its ripped abdominals by the pool, but is back to work transforming communications for business by making it better with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
Today on Face the Nation, Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee will both join us to preview the upcoming Republican presidential debate. What can we expect from Donald Trump at Thursday's debate? We'll ask him. And we'll talk to former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. He's also creating controversy out on the campaign trail. And will Vice President Joe Biden join the Democratic race? We'll get the latest on the missing Malaysian Air Flight 370 investigation and talk to Captain Sully Sullenberger about that and new concerns about near misses between drones and airplanes. We'll have plenty of political analysis, plus an in-depth look at the enormous role of money in campaign 2016. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. All eyes will be on Donald Trump Thursday when he takes the stage in Cleveland for the first Republican debate. And Donald Trump joins us by phone. Mr. Trump, you say that you've never debated before, you're not preparing, but your platform is that you're a winner and that when you get into the presidency, which has lots of things that you've never done before, you will win in that job. So why should we not expect that in this debate you won't win it too?
Well, I would hope to do well, John. I don't know when you say you had never debated. I'm not a debater. I don't stand up and debate like these politicians. They're all talk, no action. All they do is their whole life they debate, and then they don't get things done. I get things done. Now, I look forward to the debate, and when you say not preparing, I'm preparing, but I prepare by seeing what's going on. I don't have pollsters telling me every move that, you know, I can't say this, I can't say that. I don't want to have pollsters. You know, I see what these pollsters and how much they're paid by the other camps, and the other camps are frozen if they don't have their pollsters. They can't even respond. So, you know, I always say, if the pollsters were so good, why aren't they running? But I just have a life that's a good life. A lot of people never thought I was going to do this. I said I was because I want to make our country great again. And frankly, I look forward to the debate.
You have said some unfavorable things about Hillary Clinton. You're not a fan of hers. This morning, the New York Times reports that Joe Biden might be thinking about getting into the race. Rate him as a vice president for us.
Well, I think he's been very loyal to the president. That's one thing I will say. I think he's been a very loyal person, and that's, you know, a very important trait. I don't think he's going to be that effective as a campaigner. There's a lot of anger in the country. There's a lot of anger with respect to President Obama, and that would include Joe Biden, because nothing's been done. I mean, we've got a country that's in turmoil. We owe $17 trillion, $18 trillion, and that's going up to, you know, very soon we're going to crack that $20 trillion mark, John, and that's going to be catastrophic for this country. So, and it's going to happen soon. A lot of bad things happening in this country, and we don't have victories anymore. So I think it's not going to be easy for him. I also think, though, it's going to be very hard for Hillary to escape the illegality of the email scandal, because if you look at General Petraeus, his life was destroyed for doing something that was nothing compared to what she's done.
So you don't think Biden could beat Hillary?
I think that Biden would have a good chance of beating her now. I don't think he could have beaten her 6 months ago or even 3 months ago. I think the email scandal is going to be a devastating blow for Hillary. If you have an honorable prosecutor, which we'll see whether or not that happens because they're all Democrats, but if there's an honorable prosecution, that would mean that she's in big trouble. Because, again, you look at General Petraeus, a wonderful man, they destroyed him. He was destroyed over something far less and similar, but far less than what she's done. So I think she's got some very big problems, and you look at her poll numbers, they're coming down. They're coming down like a crashing rocket.
Let me ask you a question about a quote from your book, Art of the Deal, which you mentioned now and again. You said, or you wrote, the final key to the way I promote is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. Does that describe your presidential campaign, too?
I don't know exactly what does describe. I mean, I'm getting very good poll numbers. A number just came out at 28, and one at 24, and one at 20, and... You know, I'm getting very high. And if you think when you get 24 and 28% and you have 16 other candidates, because one just joined, as you know, you have 16 other candidates and you're at 24 or 28, that's a tremendous number. You know, people say, oh, that's just a small piece. Well, it's really not a small piece because as candidates start to leave, those numbers are going to be built up pretty high. And, you know, the poll numbers are very good. People are tired of being ripped off by the world. They're tired of seeing incompetent leadership. And, you know, I do a good job. I built a great company. I do a good job, whatever I do.
One of the burdens of being a front runner is that you got to release your tax returns. Hillary Clinton released some information about her wealth, showed she paid almost 40% of her income in taxes. Will you release your tax returns? And what do you think that percentage will be for you?
Well, I may tie it to a release of Hillary's emails. I may very well do that. Now, I have a very big company. They all said I wouldn't release my financials, and then I released them, and they were far bigger than anybody thought. They said I wouldn't release them because his company maybe, or his success maybe isn't as big. Well, it turned out that it's far bigger, and I released them, and we'll see what I'm going to do with tax returns. I have no major problem with it, but I may tie them to a release of Hillary's emails.
What's your guess on your percentage of income that's paid in taxes?
You know what? And I've said this many times, so it's not exactly breaking news. I pay as little as possible. I fight like hell to pay as little as possible for two reasons. Number one, I'm a businessman, and that's the way you're supposed to do it. And you put the money back into your company and employees and all of that. But the other reason is that I hate the way our government spends our taxes. I hate the way they waste our money, trillions and trillions of dollars of waste and abuse, and I hate it. And I'll be probably the first candidate in the history of politics within this country to say it. I try, and like every, by the way, like every single taxpayer out there, I try to pay as little tax as possible. And again, one of the big reasons is I hate what our country does with the money that we pay.
You mentioned you're a businessman. You've got a very long list of things you want to do. You want to beat China, defeat ISIS, build a wall, make veterans' hospitals the envy of the world. But people who've been in business who move into government are frustrated by the pace. Presidents who have left office have said they've been frustrated by how little control they have over things. Do you have the patience for the presidency?
I absolutely do. John, I've dealt in politics all my life. I've been dealing, you know, on the other side. Don't forget, I was the fair-haired boy in Republican politics and even in Democrat politics. I supported everybody. I'm a businessman, so I support everybody. And when they were there, they were always there for me. You know, I was a very good businessman. Now I'm a politician. We'll find out if I'm a good politician. I almost hate to use the term because when I think politician, it's all talk, no action. I do have the patience and I do have the leadership. The leadership is what you have to do. I don't like executive orders. That's not what the country was based on. You go, you can't make a deal with anybody, so you sign an executive order. You really need leadership. You have to get people into a room and get something that's good for everybody, whether it's compromise or whatever. But you have to get them into a room and you have to lead. And that hasn't happened under President Obama. So now he goes around signing executive orders all over the place, which at some point they're going to be rescinded or they're going to be rescinded by the courts. We'll see what happens.
One thing that happens to presidents in office is they often fail. They face failure. Tell us about a failure you experienced in the business world and what that tells us about you.
Well, I think one of the things that I've done best is when a market crashes, which is no fault of mine, I've been able to take some deals, in fact, almost all deals, and make them better. In other words, when the world changes, I have been very successful, and you can ask the great financiers who know me, because I know many of them, and they respect me a lot, and I respect them. But I've been able to take deals that should be bad deals and turn them around. And turn them around into very successful deals. A lot of that is buying time. A lot of that is negotiating with banks and, in fact, cutting banks and doing what you have to do. But I've been very, very successful at that.
All right, Donald Trump, we appreciate your time. We'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much, John. Great honor.
Next up is another Republican candidate. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee joins us from Little Rock. Thanks for joining us, Governor. I want to get to the debate in a moment, but let's start with your comments on the Iran nuclear deal. The president, you said, was marching the Israelis to the door of the oven. I want to know, has there ever been a modern debate where an argument was won by using a Nazi analogy?
I don't know if a debate has been won, but I know that we are in a very dangerous situation because of the deal with the Iranians. We've just released $150 billion so they can buy conventional weapons from the Russians and continue what is already a very deadly pursuit of terrorism around the world. We got nothing out of this deal, John. I read the whole thing. And my comments, while the president may have called them ridiculous, what's ridiculous is that we would ever trust the Iranians, who for 36 years have vowed that they will wipe Israel off the face of the map and have vowed that they will bring death to America and chanted it even during the negotiations. And as a person who has been going to Israel dozens of times over the past 42 years since 1973, and as a person who has stood in Auschwitz for three different occasions and understood the gravity of the situation, when someone is saying they're going to kill an entire group of people, we'd better take it seriously.
You say that the administration trusts the Iranian regime, but throughout this, the president and Secretary of State Kerry, plus the other members of the negotiating P5 plus one, have said they don't trust Iran, and they built this entire deal around the idea that they don't trust Iran. So I'm confused about how you say they do trust them. They've been saying they don't trust them at all. You just don't believe them.
Well, if you don't trust them, how come you give them 24 days before you actually go and do the inspection that you announce you're going to do? How come you allow them to keep their military bases off limits to the inspection? If that's trust, John, and that's the problem with this entire deal. I believe it's a money deal. If you look through, there are dozens of pages of all the companies and entities that are going to have their assets unfrozen. I cannot help but believe that a lot of this is being driven not to secure peace in the Middle East, not to make the world safer, but to make sure that a lot of people with a lot of money get their money back. And that's a tragedy. It's a real sad state of affairs when we put money ahead of national security and security for not just the people of Israel, but all of the Middle East and all of the world.
All right, let's switch to politics. The debate coming up on Thursday. What's that going to be like? Is it a reality show? Is it going to be 10 men standing in close proximity giving speeches? What's it going to be like?
Well, the format only allows for one-minute responses and a 30-second rebuttal if we're attacked by name. So probably a lot of us are sitting there hoping that we get attacked by name so we get a little more time. The challenge for the moderators of the debate is to divvy this up fairly, make it even. You know, I know a lot of times, and I hear commenters and pundits will say, this is a reality show, it's a clown car, it's a game show. But for those of us who have stuck our necks on the line to run for president, it is a very serious business of believing that our country is in real trouble. And we don't stand on that stage because we're looking for an opportunity to be on TV. Heck, I had my own television show before I left it to come do this. So this isn't about ego. It's not a vanity project. This is because we think this country is in real big trouble. And I would say, I think every other of my Republican colleagues on that stage feels exactly the same way. I'm not going to disparage why they're there. I'm going to assume they're there because the same reason I'm there, to make America a truly great country one more time.
You recently went to the AFL-CIO meeting. Why would a conservative Republican go talk to go court labor when they're not likely to vote for you?
Well, because I want to be president of all of America, not just the part that agrees with me. One of the things that I did in Arkansas when I was facing a 90% opposition that the state had in the political winds of 90% Democrats, I had to work with them. I got 48% of the African-American vote, not because they originally voted for me, but I went to them the day after the election, not the day before. I worked to become their governor, too, and after a while it worked. Here's what a lot of people don't know. 35 to 40% of the members of labor are actually Republican. And I fight hard for working men and women, whether they're in a union or not. But when we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs and 60,000 manufacturing plants have closed just since the year 2000, somebody better be attentive to the fact that whether a person is a union member or not, a lot of Americans are working really, really hard these days for a whole lot less money than they made a few years ago. So I was glad to go. I was the only Republican that accepted their invitation. Maybe they vote for me, maybe they don't. But if I can get some of their votes, because some of those union members are pro-life, some of those union members, you know, are church-going, gun-owning people that really are philosophically more Republican, except for maybe the political leanings of their union.
All right, Governor Mike Huckabee, thanks so much for being with us. We look forward to talking to you after that debate.
Thank you, John.
We turn now to the mystery of Malaysian Air Flight 370, a wing flap discovered last week off the coast of Reunion Island, more than 2,000 miles away from where the plane may have crashed, is now in France, where investigators will determine whether it was, in fact, from the plane that disappeared 16 months ago during a flight from Beijing to Kuala Lumpur. Joining us now from San Francisco is CBS News aviation and safety expert Sully Sullenberger. Sully, I want to ask you at first, from what they found, what can they learn? What can they tell from this one piece of debris?
Well, that's an interesting problem because we shouldn't make too many judgments about one single piece of debris any more than we could expect to discover why an entire house fell down by looking at one piece of lumber. But investigators, based upon over a century of knowledge about metals and structures, can begin to make some surmises. We can tell, for example, how the metal has been acted on, by what forces and in what directions. We can tell by evidence left by the metal bending and breaking what forces were acting upon it. It's also possible that they can tell whether it was a high-energy, high-speed impact or not. Although I've got to say that in many cases, even in high-speed impacts, there are some pieces of the airplane that remain remarkably intact. But what needs to be done is real investigation, hands-on, by the experts, and not just by metallurgists, but possibly by marine biologists, to tell us, for example, how long this piece may have been in the water.
You've been involved in these investigations before. You've seen how they put these puzzle pieces together. Describe that a little bit for us. What are they going to try to do if they can start finding some pieces?
Well, after the July 1996 loss of TWA Flight 800 to a fuel tank explosion, the U.S. Navy and the NTSB recovered much of the airplane, and they actually reconstructed the airplane on a framework in a hangar. And I've been to the National Transportation Safety Board Training Center outside Washington to see the reconstructed wreckage of TWA 800. And when you have more pieces of the puzzle in place, you can see the patterns where the overpressure has bent the metal. You've seen where the fractures occurred. You see the soot on the side of the exterior of the airplane. And the patterns begin to emerge, and more conclusions can be drawn from hard evidence. So ultimately, these investigators are going to be able to answer these important questions that we all have. And in a final report, what they'll essentially be doing is writing a true-life, nonfiction detective story of hundreds of pages. And right now, we're probably on page 5.
So as a final question, Sully, I want to ask you about these reports about near misses from drones and commercial airlines. How dangerous is that?
Well, because they're easy to get and they're relatively inexpensive, these devices are becoming ubiquitous. And that's true not just of drones, but of laser pointer attacks. And so it allows people to do stupid, reckless, dangerous things with abandon. I'm heartened that the aviation and the legal authorities have raised the penalties for doing these things. Unfortunately, the essential element that's still missing is the certainty of prosecution because it's been difficult to catch them in the act. This must stop.
Very quickly, though, what could possibly happen, though, with one of these drones? I mean, how bad could it get?
Well, we've seen what a 6-pound or an 8-pound bird can do to bring down an airplane. Imagine what a device containing hard parts like batteries and motors can do that might weigh 25 or possibly up to 55 pounds to bring down an airplane. It's not a matter of if it will happen. It's a matter of when it will happen.
All right, Sully Sullenberger, we thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back in 1 minute with our political panel. Stay with us.
Technology is changing the way people invest. Whether you're a multi-million dollar investor or just starting out, Betterment is the smart answer to the question, how should I manage my money? Powered by smarter technology and personalized for your financial goals, Betterment automatically manages your investments and minimizes taxes, all for a fraction of the cost of traditional financial services. You just set it and forget it. With over 95,000 customers and $2.3 billion under management, Betterment is the smarter, easier way to invest. Isn't it time you used smarter technology to build your wealth? Sign up today and receive up to 6 months free. Get full terms and conditions at betterment.com/podcast. Betterment, investing made better. Sign up for your free trial at betterment.com/podcast. That's betterment.com/podcast.
Joining us now for some political analysis, the chief correspondent for the Washington Post and the unofficial dean of the political press corps, Dan Balz. Rehan Salam is the executive editor of the National Review. Molly Ball covers politics for the Atlantic Magazine. And batting cleanup, National Journal senior political correspondent Ron Fournier. We're going to get to the debate and we're going to get to Donald Trump in a minute. But let's talk, Dan Balz, about Joe Biden. There have been reports about he's thinking maybe or not. You've been doing a lot of reporting on this. What is the state of Joe Biden's thinking about a presidential run?
A couple of things. One, he has never ruled out running in 2016. And so he has a decision to make and he will make that decision within the next few months. We don't exactly know when. He is getting pressure. He's getting encouragement, however you want to describe it, from a lot of people to make a serious look at this, to consider it. There doesn't seem to be anything active at this point. There doesn't seem to be an organization that he's putting together. I think there's a lot of incoming and they're mulling.
People closest to him are saying it's still very unlikely that he runs.
A lot of cold water being thrown on this.
Yes,
idea.
But I have to say that this is a boomlet that I think most people in D.C. would admit that or say that Joe Biden deserves, and it's great for him to get this kind of respect and attention, but it's very unlikely that he runs.
Molly, what would the obstacles be for Joe Biden as a candidate?
Well, the number one obstacle is Hillary Clinton. Despite all of the negativity that's come her way, she is still a very formidable frontrunner. Now, people in Biden's orbit don't see a campaign that they think is particularly well-run. They see her stumbling. They see that there's a possibility that she continues to deteriorate in terms of her approval ratings and so on, and that Democrats look for a backup plan that has a little bit more of a profile, a little bit more credibility than the other Democrats currently in the race. I think they also perceive that while there's a search for an alternative to Hillary, it's not so much on policy grounds as on personality grounds. Right. And so there's been a gravitation to Bernie Sanders because of his authenticity. Mm-hmm. That's something that Joe Biden has in spades.
Yeah, Rayon. There's not an animating policy idea behind this.
I disagree with this line of thinking for this reason. I think that actually Donald Trump was a weirdly astute political analyst when he said that, you know, look, there's a lot of anger in the country, and it's not just in the country. If you look at working class, lower middle class people in Italy, in the UK, in all kinds of Western democracies, there is this huge enthusiasm for nationalist and populist candidates. And I think that a lot of Democrats want to think, well, that's a Trump thing. That's just among Republicans. It's not. That exists among Democrats, too. And I don't think that Joe Biden, having been vice president all this time, is going to be able to tap into it.
There's right. a point here. There's people like Donald Trump rise in this country when voters and their leaders lose the audacity, the hope, and they cling to the status quo. And that's what both parties are doing right now. And Trump is playing into that.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump. We had a conversation with him this morning. We've got this debate coming up Thursday. John Weaver, who works for John Kasich, another candidate who may make the stage, said preparing for the debate was like preparing for a NASCAR race where one of the drivers had been drinking. He didn't say which candidate he was talking about there. Dan Balz, for Donald Trump, what does he have to do? He's at the top of the polls, but what's his next move? What does he have to do?
I think for Donald Trump, the challenge is to present a personality or persona on that stage that is less bombastic than he is in some of his interviews. I thought the interview he did this morning was very effective. I mean, he dealt with the questions in an interesting way. He was very much Donald Trump. If he can come off that way and avoid attacking others, avoid the kind of negativism that he's projected on the campaign trail, then he could have a very successful debate.
Molly, Donald Trump's negatives are very high in a Quinnipiac poll this week. 30% of Republicans said they would never vote for him. Hillary Clinton also has high negatives. Why are negatives a bigger problem for Donald Trump and not for Hillary Clinton? What's different about what he faces?
I think what you see with Donald Trump is someone who is not a professional politician and has gained some strength from that, but who also has taken a lot of contradictory positions. Hillary's problem is less about policy. She doesn't say a lot of things that many Democrats disagree with. It's just a question about whether she's trusted, whether she is liked, whether she's sort of a warm and fuzzy character. You have sort of the opposite with Donald Trump, and something that a lot of Republicans I've been talking to say they're looking at in approaching the debate is if they can try to pin him down on specifics and reveal that he has a really hard time answering a lot of these policy questions. He's very good at the bombast and the, you know, he's a world-class entertainer. That's sort of what he does. And so they think that maybe the way to sort of bring him down to earth is to really get him on some policy questions.
John, her negatives are going to be...
Ron, we got to go. We'll be right back. We'll be back with all of you. Stay with us. We'll be back with our panel in a moment.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better with voice-over internet. After such an achievement, who would have blamed Vonage if they said, "Enjoy better, people. We'll be by the pool." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not unleashing its ripped abdominals by the pool, but is back to work transforming communications for business by making it better with award-winning cloud-based solutions, an infrastructure that grows as you grow, seamless mobility between all devices so you never miss that important call, even if you're splishy-splashing in the pool that Vonage isn't, because Vonage is too busy making communications better, and all for so much less than you think. So when you're reapplying your SPF 45, Vonage won't be there to rub it in. Because Vonage will be out there, somewhere, doing more better. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call Vonage at 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We continue with our political panel. Dan Balls is chief correspondent at The Washington Post. Rehan Salam is executive editor of the National Review. Molly Ball covers politics for The Atlantic. And Ron Fournier is the senior political correspondent for National Journal. Ron, I cut you off with a hard stop, but tell me what you were going to say.
Was it because I was going to challenge the premise of your question?
Yes, but never do that.
Hillary Clinton's negative ratings are a factor in the race. They're going to make it harder for her to win the nomination if she does. They're going to make it harder for her to win the presidency if she does. And they're going to make it impossible for her to be a transformational leader if she wins. She has to fix these ratings. Now let's talk about Trump. My point on Trump kind of linked to her. He needs to go against type. Imagine if Hillary Clinton had run an incredibly authentic, very nimble, very, very transparent campaign. She'd be in a far different position now because it would blow people's minds. It would be against the typecast they had of her coming into this race. Instead, she's played a type. What if Donald Trump at the campaign kind of acts like he did on that phone call? If he's serious, if he's substantial, if he's not being bombastic. That would, and he doesn't even have to be that serious. It would blow people's minds, and that's what he has to do, is play against type.
Yeah.
One thing that I found very striking about the interview you conducted is that, you know, when Donald Trump was asked about his taxes, he simply said, "I try to pay as little as possible." And the thing is that, you know, for most voters, I think their instinct is that, well, of course that's true, and that's probably true of everyone else too, and yet they must preemptively apologize. So here is Donald Trump not preemptively apologizing in that way. And I think if you're looking at Democrats too, you know, in the 90s, there's a sense among the liberal grassroots that you had Democrats who were apologizing for being Democrats constantly. And then, you know, after the Iraq War, there is this belief that we need a new kind of Democrat. Among Republicans, too, now there's a sense they're out of step with the country, and so they're in a defensive crouch. They have to apologize for who they are. They have to somehow, you know, seem more appealing, and I think that that makes them seem inauthentic, and that's what Trump is capitalizing on.
I was struck in that interview when he said, "I'm now a politician." I mean, it was as though he has made a transition from being Donald Trump, the business guy, with all the bombast, to being somebody who now thinks of himself in the political environment. And I wonder how much that will change him as he goes forward.
Do you think his rivals are cutting that ad already?
Well,
and like
perhaps.
A true politician, he totally ducked the last question about mistakes he'd made. Molly, I want to ask you about Hillary Clinton. On Friday, she released a whole bunch of information about her tax returns. There was a letter about her health. What was that about?
Well, I think, as Ron said, this perception of her not being transparent, which I think is not just a media narrative, it's a fact that the Clintons, especially Hillary, are very guarded, very secretive people. And this has erupted into multiple controversies, including the email scandal. And so they realize that's hurting them, and they're trying to present a sort of charade of transparency, I think, by by releasing some of this stuff and trying to seem upfront about it, trying to seem as if she is actually being more forthcoming with some of the information that I think would have to come out eventually. So her taxes, for example, as you mentioned before, showing that she paid about a 35% tax rate on a whole lot of income, $28 million in the last year. So this is a perception that I think she's finally starting to try to attack.
Ron, one thing I want to ask you about, she also did on Friday, and we'll listen to a clip of her here now. She took on Jeb Bush in a speech on Friday.
They can't rise if the minimum wage is too low to live on. They can't rise if their governor makes it harder for them to get a college education. And you cannot seriously talk about the right to rise and support laws that deny the right to vote.
So, Ron, Hillary Clinton there using Right to Rise, which is the name of the Jeb Bush PAC. The governor she's talking about is Jeb Bush. Why take on Jeb Bush?
Because she thinks he's going to run for president against her. The Jeb Bush campaign whined about that attack. They were caught off guard. I actually think, hey, you know, all's fair in love and war. I thought it was a good attack. What bothered me about Hillary Clinton last week was another attack she took, actually a much more effective and disingenuous one, against the New York Times. The New York Times wrote a story last week about a new development in the email scandal, sloppily written and not very transparently corrected. If you're a media writer, a lot of reasons to criticize the New York Times. But what did they get right? Two IGs have asked the Department of Justice to look into the fact that classified documents were found on her rules-defying, oversight-thwarting email server. This is after she said there were no classified documents. This is after she said that she hasn't violated any rules. This is after she said that she's too transparent in all this. And after she said she only did all this out of a matter of convenience. None of those statements are true. So we have some serial disingenuous behavior of the Clinton campaign, and they're trying to deflect by making this a story about the New York Times. I think there's a big story and big questions that have to be asked about what she's hiding on the emails, why she's not being transparent, and why she's not following the rules.
This, Dan.
Well, I want to go back to the issue of her negatives, which no doubt are in part a reflection of people's reaction to the emails and other things. I think that this is something that has to concern the Clinton campaign. I mean, they cannot take this lightly. And my assumption is that they are going to have to deal with this and perhaps deal with it fairly quickly in order to try to move people away from that. The attack on Jeb Bush, I think, is a sign that she is continuing to play to the Democratic base, that she's got Bernie Sanders at least in one eye, if not more, and that she is trying to convince Democrats that she has not just the policies, but the fight and the spirit to go after the Republicans in a way that nobody else will be able to do.
Rayon, she was at an event, at an Urban League event, where Jeb Bush was also speaking.
Yes.
What is the response from Jeb Bush on this idea?
Well, look, Jeb Bush gave a speech that was very bipartisan. He quoted President Obama in his remarks, and he said that Obama was right on many important points. You know, he was incredibly civil, and he was trying to, you know, get applause lines from this audience, and that's entirely fair enough. But he never actually responded to a direct attack from Hillary Clinton. And then, of course, it's the same week that you had the cover of Time magazine, and you had George W. Bush and Bill Clinton buddy-buddy right next to each other with talk of, you know, how closely they work together. This is absolutely toxic because it's a sense that this country is run by two political dynasties that are thoroughly enmeshed with family, business, commercial ties. How are you going to run against Hillary Clinton given these concerns if you're someone who appears to be, you know, so very similar and just unwilling to fire back? Hillary Clinton is close but is quite happy to attack Jeb Bush when she feels it necessary. Can Jeb Bush do the same?
If I could double back with Dan, I agree she's got to put this behind her quickly. I don't know how she does. Do you have any idea what she does short of handing the server back to the IG?
Well, I don't think she's obviously going to do that. No, I mean, she's going to have to figure out a way as a candidate or through the campaign to deliver a message that's counter to the idea that people have of her at this point.
But if you don't turn back the public's emails, how do you counter that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the challenge of being Robbie Mook or John Podesta or anybody else in that campaign.
We want to take a look now at the driving force behind the 2016 campaign, money. Friday, the super PACs, those political action committees full of cash, filed their first reports. Taken together with the reports filed by the individual candidates, they provide the first look at who is paying for the campaign. Jeb Bush is at the head of the Republican PAC. His combined totals are nearly $120 million, followed by Ted Cruz with $53 million, Marco Rubio at $26 million, and Scott Walker with $20 million. Hillary Clinton has raised $69 million. Super PAC donations are unlimited and mostly unregulated. So far, 61 people and entities have given more than $1 million to the Super PACs, which are on tap to flood the airwaves with ads, most of them negative, and finance turnout the vote operations. The trend is clear. Wealthy donors are gaining more and more influence over the campaign process. Case in point, a handful of Republican candidates this week are all in California meeting with the Charles and David Koch brothers, huge backers of Republicans, to make their case and hopefully plug into their network, which has promised to spend $900 million on the candidate of their choice. In a recent New York Times CBS News poll, 84% of the country said that they believed money had too much influence in American political campaigns. 66% said that the wealthy have a greater chance to influence elections than other Americans. Joining us now to discuss the role of money in campaign 2016, former FEC commissioner, a Republican appointee, Trevor Potter. He is now president of the watchdog group, the Campaign Legal Center. Matea Gold covers campaign money for The Washington Post. Stephen Law is the head of American Crossroads, which is a conservative political action committee. And CBS News correspondent Juliana Goldman, who covers money for us. Welcome to all of you. Juliana, I want to start with you. Every campaign we learn that more money was spent than the campaign before. That's likely to be happening again this time. But what's different?
There are really three differences here from cycles past. One is the evolution of super PACs and how campaigns and super PACs have figured out ways of working closely together without coordinating. And then they've been able to do that, and this gets to number two, because the FEC, which is supposed to police the way money is spent, is essentially toothless and dysfunctional and can't police the money that's being spent this year. And then you also have the dark money, the money that's not disclosed, that's being given to nonprofits. And we're going to be seeing more dark money this cycle. And nearly every individual candidate has a nonprofit that is associated with them. And that's what's very different this cycle.
So, Matea, we have two different animals on the Serengeti here. We have a super PAC and what people call dark money. Can you help us understand or remember the distinctions and difference between those two?
Sure. And just to step back, I think it's important to remember we actually have now two systems of political finance in our country. We have the regulated system in which candidates and parties can raise limited amounts of money that is disclosed. And then we have this growing universe of vast, unlimited contributions, often secret donations. So super PACs have to disclose all their donors. Nonprofits cannot be focused exclusively on politics, and they can keep their donors a secret. And both of those entities are now supporting all the presidential candidates in various ways, or nearly all of them. And what we're seeing, I think, in this cycle, which is so different than in cycles past, is that this universe of unlimited money is now starting to overtake the universe of regulated money.
So, Trevor, you've been worried about campaign finance for a long time, trying to fix the system. What worries you about the current state of things?
I think it's the potential for corruption, the appearance of corruption, that the Supreme Court mentioned in the post-Watergate period when we first had these rules. Matea talks of two systems. I think the problem is the two systems have essentially merged. You have these enormous sums of money being raised by supposedly outside groups that are not outside in anyone's imagination.
And you mean outside meaning outside of the candidate?
Right.
Okay.
So the legal limit you can give to a candidate is $2,700. And yet, for almost all of the presidential candidates, you see that there are groups that they have helped create, that their aides are running, that have raised many times what the campaigns have raised themselves. So that you'll see a report saying that a candidate raised, Jeb Bush, $100 million. Well, they're really talking about the super PAC, which has contributions of over $1 million. And where I think that leads is that average citizens look at this and say, well, you know, this is a game for billionaires. It's one billionaire talking to another billionaire. Where do I fit into this?
Well, and it's not just average citizens who are making that claim. Donald Trump has built his campaign a little bit around the idea that he can't be bought. Let's listen to something he said just about this idea of who's owning the elections.
I'm not doing what's right for a man that gave me $1 million to run for office, and I owe him. And when Bush gets $100 million plus, and when Hillary gets $50 million plus, every one of those people that put up money will control Bush. Control. I don't mean like a little bit. Bush is controlled by those people. Walker is controlled by those people. Hillary Clinton is controlled by those people.
So, Stephen, let me ask you about this, because what Donald Trump is touching on, whether you agree with the specifics of his claim, is something that we see in our polls again and again, that people basically think that money calls the tune and that it's a small group of people calling the tune. You actually have talked to people donating to groups. What does it look like from your vantage point?
Sure. First of all, I mean, I have to comment on the irony of a multi-billionaire like Donald Trump, who's self-financing his campaign, complaining about the amount of money in politics, but I'll leave it to him to sort out that irony. But no, it's true. I mean, we do spend a lot of time talking to donors. I actually talk to people on the other side of the coin, Democrats who talk to donors. And most donors, the vast majority of them, are motivated by a desire to see the direction of the country change in a broad way. They're concerned, in our case, they give to Crossroads because they're concerned about the direction of the country, a flatline economy. They're concerned about where Hillary Clinton would take the country. And they are hoping to invest in us to try to change that scenario. I read with interest some of the comments from people who had given to the Right to Rise organization. Mike Fernandez, the largest donor, says the thing he feels passionately about, he disagrees strongly with Jeb Bush on, which is normalization of relations with Cuba. So what people are doing is they're investing in a chance to change the country, and that's how they view it. And that's, again, what motivates people on both the left and the right.
Right to Rise being the super PAC for Jeb Bush, one of these outside groups that runs in parallel to his actual campaign. Juliana.
Well, it's interesting with Right to Rise. One of the data figures that they boasted was that 95% of their donations were $25,000. Or less. So it just shows you where we have come from 4 years ago when you have campaigns, part of the other system that Mateo was talking about, boasting of donations, of small dollar donations of $200 or $250 or less. But that is the big question this cycle, and it's what the chair of the FEC says, is that it's going to be very difficult to know whether certain candidates are taking certain policy positions, because that is what is being pushed by a multimillionaire, billionaire backer writing seven-figure checks.
You know, one thing I kind of find interesting in this vein is, you know, right now what's been going on this last week that's not been commented on is that the AFL-CIO and all of its unions are holding essentially a beauty contest for the Democratic candidates. They're sitting them all down. They're making decisions about where they're going to invest their financial support this election cycle. And they're walking through with each of those candidates a very detailed list of the policies that they want to see action on. Organized labor has always done this. They're unabashed and unashamed about connecting financial political support with your support for their policy agenda. Yet people don't seem to be terrifically concerned about that, but that is another area where there's a huge amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars spent to advocate for a very, very particular set of policy agendas.
John, I think Steve's absolutely right. This is a bipartisan problem. It's silly to pretend that just we're focusing on Republicans because there's so many candidates running and there's so many super PACs. But both sides have this same issue. Professor Larry Lessig calls dependency corruption, which means you're dependent on the people who finance you. And it used to be we had a broad base, we had a presidential public funding system, you got small donations, they were matched, you got presidential public funding in the general. That's who Ronald Reagan was elected by twice. Today, you've got a tiny group of people. In 2012, 90% of the contributions to these super PACs came from 523 people. These candidates become focused on the support of such a tiny group of people, which is so important because these super PACs are raising far more money than they're going to raise. And the result is when they get into government, you know, who are they going to take a call from? Who are they going to listen to?
Mateo.
So I think what's important to focus on as well is not just what donors think they're going to get for their money, but how it's changing our politics. The role that big donors are playing in 2016 has already revamped the entire political process. We saw candidates hold off announcing their candidacy so they could actually work in closer coordination with outside groups and super PACs so they could raise and ask for huge sums of money. And we're seeing them focus their attention really on the tiny, tiny group of people who can afford to write seven and eight figure checks.
So one of the ways it's changing the system is the Koch brothers are having a gathering that Republican candidates are going to. And so they're spending their time pitching to what's been called the Koch primary, right?
Yeah, and this is an opportunity to voice their policy prescriptions for small limited government, and it's an opportunity for the network of donors to hear from them directly.
Any candidate who spends all his time just focused on donors and what they want will not succeed, because ultimately the people who cast the votes and determine whether you're the nominee or the candidate are the voters. The donors, the financing of campaigns by whatever means is a means to an end. It's an amplification system.
Another way it's changing the way politics takes place is primaries are lasting longer because candidates can live. It used to be you got knocked out when you ran out of money. That's no longer the case.
So what's so dramatic this cycle is that nearly every single presidential candidate has a personalized super PAC. We saw the beginnings of this in 2012 and the impact that had. And Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum both had their candidacies kept alive by wealthy donors who gave through a super PAC. And arguably Mitt Romney really was able to last through a very long, bloody primary fight because he had a very well-funded super PAC behind them. Now everyone has a super PAC, and in fact, four out of the $5 raised to support Republican candidates so far have been raised for outside groups. So we're looking at the prospect of an incredibly long, drawn-out primary fight again, because you never know who's going to be able to get a second wind if a donor decides to write a big check.
Great. Then the money that we're going to be seeing this weekend, these are essentially down payments. You know, it used to be that when a candidate runs out of money, they have to drop out. Now it's when they run out of their sugar daddy or their sugar mama who's funding their super PAC.
We used to have the two systems we've been talking about. You said they're melding it into one. There used to be a cop on the beat, the FEC, that would kind of try and keep those two systems apart. The cop's not on the beat.
Well, the chair of the FEC has referred to the commission as worse than dysfunctional. When I was on the commission, I think there was one vote where we tied 3-3 in the 5 years I was there. Now that essentially happens all the time, and the result of that is the commission, which requires a majority, four votes, to do anything, is deadlocked, gridlocked, paralyzed, and not able to deal with complaints that come in. And so I think what's happened in the political world is people have said, well, you know, no one's going to go after this anyway. It always took years, but now it's just not going to happen. And so you've ended up in a situation which clearly the Supreme Court didn't intend. And Citizens United, when it said corporations could spend unlimited money and basically said this independent speech is a good thing, they said it's going to be fully disclosed, which it has not been. We have the dark money you pointed out, the secret money that goes in, and that it would be completely, wholly independent of parties and candidates. And it's not. These are groups that are visibly set up. There's an argument that they will make, well, I set it up before I became a candidate, or I'm not actually
in the super PACs.
The super PACs.
The super PAC before I was a candidate.
And then these other groups. So the FEC is essentially now out of the game. And the result of that is people are pushing the lines. And when a candidate sees someone else doing something, they dive in and do it as well, because they don't want to be at a disadvantage.
Any chance for reform or change of this system, Matea?
Well, one thing that I find so striking is that campaign operatives and campaign finance attorneys you speak to on both sides of the aisle today actually are in agreement. The system is not working. The center cannot hold. There is a direct conflict between these huge sums of money on one side and these very small limited contributions on the other. So the question is what direction it goes in. And if you talk to advocates for stricter campaign finance rules, such as Mr. Potter, a lot of people are saying, well, this is going to lead to such a big scandal that there will be another sort of reform movement. Watergate led to the creation of the Federal Election Commission. We saw the Clinton soft money scandals led to the McCain-Feingold Act. I do think it's possible, however, that we could see a push to big money coming back to candidates and parties. That's something that Republicans have been advocating for, and if Republicans take Congress and the White House, we could see that come to pass.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Sorry, Trevor, we'll get on this issue again. Thanks, all of you. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were Donald Trump, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and Captain Sully Sullenberger. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hendon and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.